the noon of Friday, March the 2nd, 2012. We have a quorum to conduct business. Senator Coghill is here, Vice Chair Senator Wilkowski, and myself, Senator French. Today we're going to explore a legal question, and the legal question is, how do you bond a project that mines through a salmon stream? About a year ago, I wrote a letter to the commissioner, then commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, Dan Sullivan, asking him this question. The Chewitna mine had come to my attention in a couple of small ways through different news articles I'd seen, and one day at the office, I began exploring the Alaska Surface Coal Mining Control and Reclamation Act. And as I read through that act, I saw that there was a bonding requirement, and I began thinking about that. And I wrote the commissioner a letter, and I'll just read a couple of the paragraphs of that letter to let the public kind of get oriented to what we're doing here today. Said that, Commissioner, I'm writing you out of concern regarding one aspect of the permitting process with respect to this proposed mine there in the Chewitna watershed. Pacrim's plan, Pacrim is the company that applied for a permit, Pacrim's plan for the mine development would remove 11 miles of Middle Creek, which is a major tributary of the Chewitna River and a stream identified by the Department of Fish and Game as significant to salmon, and by remove I mean just that. The plan calls for diverting all of the water out of the stream bed, the removal of more than 300 feet of overburden, and then mining the exposed coal seams. While there's currently no law in the books that prohibits mining through a stream, in contrast to the logging rules which require buffers around salmon streams, the reclamation bond statute stands as a significant hurdle for this project to clear. The bond is in place to make certain that Pacrim fulfills its obligation to complete its reclamation plan. The difficult issue you face as the commissioner is in setting the amount of the reclamation bond, given the absence of any precedent in Alaska for permitting mining in active salmon streams. I went on to point out that there was a case, Trustees of Alaska versus Gorsuch from the 1992 era, that had dealt with several legal questions surrounding this exact same proposal through a financial predecessor of Pacrim Coal. And I mentioned that when DNR sets the amount of the reclamation bond, DNR must assume that the applicant will violate its permit terms. This assumption, in my view, took on greater significance given the difficulty of Pacrim's restoration obligations. So based on that letter, I've had sort of an enduring interest in this question, and we have the opportunity today to hear from some people, scientists, who can give us some guidance, give us and the department some guidance on this. And I propose it will take probably 30 to 40 minutes to hear from one side, 30 minutes to hear from the other side of the department, and then a few minutes of rebuttal the first side. So we have today Dr. Margaret Palmer here, we have Mr. Lance Trasky, we have Dr. David Chambers, and they are the three who are presenting on behalf of, we'll say, the Chewitna watershed. And I don't know who wants to go first. I think it's Dr. Palmer that wants to come first. Dr. Palmer, why don't you come on up? Welcome to Juneau.
Thank you.
It's nice to have you here.
Wonderful to be here. Beautiful as I was flying in. I enjoyed it.
Great. Go ahead and put yourself on the record. That would be your name and affiliation, if any, and the floor is yours.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman French and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Margaret Palmer. I want to thank you for allowing me to speak today. I'm a professor at the University of Maryland, and I'm also director of the National Science Foundation's Socio-Environmental Synthesis Center, which is located in Annapolis, Maryland. I've been researching streams and watersheds for over 25 years, and I'm an expert in stream restoration and have dealt with a lot of work on the impacts of surface mining on streams. As you know, Pacrim Coal has proposed a large mining project in the Chewitna River watershed. It's a 25-year project that will impact a very large tract of land, not only due to the footprint itself where the mining will occur, but because of all the infrastructure and access needs for mining, such as roads, buildings, etc. Those impacts will affect fragile wetlands and destroy 11 miles of salmon streams, as the chairman noted. So I'm here as a scientist to describe what I believe is overwhelming evidence that the impacts will be irreversible simply because the reclamation is not technologically feasible. So I want to make three points in my statement. One deals with the nature of the reclamation examples that Pacrim provided. The second deals with the difference between stream creation and restoration. And the third deals with the failure rate of stream restoration. So with respect to point one, PACRIM put forward a number of examples that they suggest are evidence that reclamation of the wetlands and the streams lost due to the project here is technologically feasible. In fact, if you look at those examples carefully, they provide case studies on sites that were only minimally impacted, nothing like the kinds of impacts that would occur if the project goes through at Chewitna. Their examples are in watersheds that have intact headwaters. They're dealing with streams that are still connected longitudinally, and they're ones in which the groundwater flow paths are still intact. In fact, most of the examples they give are for sections of a stream that have been degraded or diverted. In the Chewitna case, with mining up to depths of more than 300 feet, the entire watershed will be destroyed. Existing groundwater flow paths will be gone, and wetlands that feed the streams will be lost. So the examples that PACRIM cites are not cases where entire headwaters and streams are gone. They were not examples where streams and wetlands were mined through down to bedrock with huge earth-moving equipment that disrupts fragile layers of organic-rich soils and ancient rock layers, such as shown over here in a diagram. With respect to the second point, what PACRIM is proposing is nothing like stream restoration as is commonly practiced today. Instead, it is an attempt to create a stream de novo. The salmon streams will be completely destroyed, leaving deep pits or trenches. Mining waste will then be moved into those to fill those. And when mining is complete across the entire watershed, PACRIM will dig ditches and hope that water flows into them. So those will be that will be the nature of the streams that are created. This is not restoration. In practice, stream restoration actually varies along a continuum where the sort of the easiest is removing ongoing impacts and then letting the stream recover on its own. For example, preventing point source from going in, pollution from going into a stream. That's one example. Then another of a stream restoration along that continuum would be enhancing, for example, in-stream habitat by providing extra wood in the stream or replanting riparian vegetation. And this is done typically on an otherwise healthy stream. And then at the extreme for stream restoration, you're talking about manipulation of an existing channel, so maybe creating another bend in the channel or regrading the banks. But under the plan proposed for Chewitna, there won't be any remaining channels to restore. They'll be gone. Simply digging ditches and hoping that water will flow to them does not create a living, healthy stream that supports insects, fish, wildlife, and of course, certainly not salmon.
Let me just ask you a question. Well, and I'll invite other members to jump in at any time. Are you aware of any other project in the world that has been conducted or done under these similar circumstances where you actually remove a stream and then recreate it after a number of years?
In terms of anything successful, absolutely not. And in fact, I led a project that created the first comprehensive national database of river and stream restoration in the U.S., and there's 38,000 restoration projects in that, and there's not a single one that falls along these lines at all. As I said, it lies outside the realm of what's scientifically considered restoration.
And Senator Wilkowski.
What's the plan? What is what is the mine company planning on doing with the current stream? Are they diverting it or just...
No, they will dig through the stream all the way down to bedrock and below. And so the stream will be gone. As
it passes through the water that's coming from upstream when it hits that big hole.
Well, you should probably ask the hydrologist about that. I don't know what the hydrological flow paths will be. And actually, that's part of the problem, is that the existing flow paths will be destroyed. And you'll hear soon from one of the other persons, one of the other scientists is going to comment what is and is not known about those hydrological flow paths.
I've been pondering Senator Wilkowski's question myself. What happens to the water that's got to flow into that? I mean, this is a large area.
Yes, it's a huge area.
Right, it's like 10 miles of stream, and so there's all sorts of associated water flowing into that sort of drainage, what becomes of it?
Well, to even begin to answer that question, you'd have to do a lot of work to try and determine exactly what the structure of the groundwater flow paths are right now. It's extremely complicated. As you'll hear, there's a lot of faulting. There's complex flow paths. And even if we knew those, it's not clear what would happen after the...
Can I just get some basic
parameters?
How big is this stream? Is it, you know, a couple hundred yards wide? How deep is it? I mean, how big of a stream are we talking about?
Well, it's a stream large enough to support salmon. I don't know the exact width of the stream, but they do migrate up in there. They dig ribs for laying their eggs. And, in fact, what you hear from Mr. Trasky is that the groundwater that upwells from the existing flow paths that are there now is what keeps the water warm enough to allow the eggs to survive through the winters that are obviously pretty serious in Alaska. So if you disrupt those flow paths, even if you get water to flow to the stream, so let's say they could line the channel somehow and create slopes so that water flowed down, you would not have those flow paths necessarily to try and keep the eggs warm enough to survive through the winter so that the young fish hatch.
So salmon eggs need groundwater.
They do.
I didn't know that.
They do. They do. So I had one more point I wanted to make, and then I'm happy to answer some more questions. And that is that there actually is a very high failure rate on restoration projects that are far simpler than what they're trying to do. And so what this means is that large-scale failure at Chewitna is inevitable. I mentioned the project that I led where we looked at 38,000 different projects. Many of those attempted, you know, were basically just attempting to, as I said, regrade stream banks, perhaps plant riparian buffers. And of the extensive publications that have come out, particularly in the last 10 years when the field has advanced significantly, that is the field of stream restoration, there's a long list of studies, and the failures typically include inability to restore even the insect community that would be necessary to support the fish. So the fact is really that the current status of technology for stream reclamation is limited to small scales, usually at single reaches of a stream. It's only useful in intact water networks, and it's certainly not designed nor tested for situations in which the underlying soils, geology, and associated groundwater flow paths are destroyed. So I just want to summarize by leaving you with my view that there's no evidence that reclamation of the streams and wetlands in Chewitna is feasible because of the extensive nature both aerially and with respect to depth. And there's strong evidence that, in fact, it's not feasible based on rigorous science, in which really much simpler projects have not necessarily led to restoration, particularly of salmonids. So the current technology that has been successful in watersheds to date are much more modest projects. So you should recognize that if the watershed is mined as proposed, you will not regain the salmon populations that frequent the streams now. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Thank you, Dr. Palmer. Further questions for Dr. Palmer? Maybe just tell me what your remind me again what your position is with the National Science Foundation.
Yes, I am the director. I'm a professor at the University of Maryland, and the National Science Foundation wanted to fund a new center to do state-of-the-art research on environmental issues to balance the needs of people and the environment. And so I received a $60 million grant from the National Science Foundation to direct this center. And we just opened our doors about 6 months ago. So it's an international center that hosts researchers from all over the world, certainly from Alaska, to come and do work there.
We're honored to have you here in front of the committee today. It's a privilege. Thank you. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. I'm just looking ahead to one of the other presentations where we'll see, and it looks like there are about 30, maybe more, permits and authorizations that the mine would have to get in order to do this. And, you know, are you saying that among these 30 permits and authorizations that the laws are not sufficient to protect the reclamation of a salmon stream like this?
That's correct. While I'm not going to pretend I'm familiar with the permitting process in Alaska in detail, if my understanding of that, and it's similar to other states, is that there's a lot of individual requirements, but that there's not any form of a comprehensive evaluation that would put all the pieces together, and certainly not one that would evaluate the kind of comprehensive mitigation plan that I expect could be proposed if a permit is file is put in place.
Sure. Of these 78 independent mm-hmm. restoration projects, do you know, did they go through this extensive sort of NEPA process and permitting process that this stream would have?
For the ones that were done in the United States, they absolutely did. Some of those were also done in Europe and Australia. But absolutely, they did. So I've also worked fairly extensively looking at projects in the Appalachian regions of West Virginia, Kentucky, where there's a lot of coal mining going on. So I'm pretty familiar with the kinds of projects that have been attempted.
Thank you. Senator Coghill.
Thank you. And I appreciate you coming up here. I tried to do a little bit of research before we got all this. I must confess I didn't get all this information until this morning, so I'm way behind the power curve on this. But from your perspective on the National Science Foundation, is your perspective to protect the streams at the cost of any human activity, or is it fish habitat, or is it biological integrity? I think one of the concerns that many people have is that, you know, no activity is what a lot of people want, and people are the problem, and nature is the solution.
Sure.
So help me understand it.
No, I totally understand your point. And first of all, I need to be clear that, you know, my role is not to say, what's good or bad. It's to try and tell you something about the scientific evidence of whether or not you're likely to get salmon restored under the present plan. I do not think all human activities should be stopped, or I wouldn't have received this award for this new center. I believe strongly that we have to be pragmatic about the decisions we make, and we have to balance what the benefits and costs are. But I also think we need to be scientifically honest about what's possible and what's not. And so I'm just trying to provide information based on all the research that's been done to date.
Yeah, and Mr. Chairman, this is the first time I've actually had a chance to look at the Chewitna, so there's no way I could make any kind of judgment calls on this, so I'm trying to keep a very open mind. But I've also been a participant in many things in Alaska where huge kind of economic interests clash, and we can have experts on either side, and so that's one reason I wanted to know what your bias was, if there was any, and because notwithstanding this particular project, we're going to hear similar arguments on every project in Alaska. And so I'm trying to get a context, so thank you.
And I, just to make one response back, and I appreciate that, and what I would ask is that you try and look at the evidence that's supported by the peer-reviewed literature, mm-hmm. because at least you have some sense that that's been looked at by the scientific community, and it's not coming from a specific perspective one way or the other.
So. Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Just maybe one more sentence about peer review and what that means, and then Senator Wilikowski, then we're going to have to move on, but go ahead.
Sure. Well, the concept of peer review is simply that when a project is done, when a scientific study is done and it's written up, it is then sent out to other scientific experts that are in the field who evaluate it anonymously and judge whether or not the information that's presented in there is done in an objective way. That's very different from a report that comes from someone that has been hired by a particular company to evaluate something, and they don't show data. Nowadays, to publish something in the peer-reviewed literature, you actually have to be able to provide your data, the original data. And there's the National Science Foundation now has a requirement that data be publicly available and be posted on a website. This is not something that's real common when you look at reports that are produced for companies, whether or not it's for something considered positive for the environment or something that others might consider negative.
Thank you for that. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, again, just looking forward to the administration's presentation. And they cite Alaska law. First of all, Alaska law is that there has to be a reclamation plan, and part of the reclamation plan has to be stream replacement. And then what they say in their performance standards, reclamation performance standards, is that stream channels disturbed need to be reestablished in a stable condition or location.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess my question is, are you saying it's just impossible to reclaim this, or are you saying that it is possible to to meet the law. The law is, must be established in a stable, a stream channels disturbed need to be reestablished in a stable condition or location. Are you saying it's they're capable of meeting the law, but the stream will essentially be dead? Or are you saying that it's just impossible to get to meet this legal standard?
Well, you know.
You see what
I understand, except I'm not a lawyer, so I don't
want to. Well, maybe I'm more rules.
Yeah,
I
know.
I don't know who the expert is. Maybe there is one or not.
So. To me, the key word is stream, and, you know, you can have a stable channel, a stable ditch, but that doesn't create a stream with the kind of organic material and so forth that will support a salmon population.
Excellent.
Sir Cargill?
Yeah.
On that point.
Sure, on that point. So in your extensive surveys, I know that in Alaska we have had meandering rivers for years and years and years. We have actually had whole new streams set up where spawning did occur that had not previously occurred. So in restoration, is that something that you have studied out, that in a more sterile stream that spawning has been reset? I think we have a couple of incidences in Alaska, I think, that we may be able to point to. And I was just wondering if this particular case falls into that type of a study group.
Right. Now, that's a really good question. Yes, there are success stories for restoration. The big difference there is there aren't success stories of restoration where the entire watershed and the source of the water flow and the ground flow patterns have been totally destroyed. When we're talking going down more than 300 feet, going through bedrock, stream restoration deals with surface processes. You may add a channel, meander, and reconnect it, and you may get salmon moving from that. That's nothing like what is being proposed in this particular case, which is why I said this is outside the realm of what's considered stream restoration or reclamation.
I wish we had another hour for you, Doctor. We have several other witnesses. And if it's
yeah, and again, maybe for another witness, but I'm just trying to get, is it, because we ultimately, I guess the commission ultimately has to set a bond number if he goes ahead with this. And are you saying it's just impossible to do this, or could you do it with some enormous amount of money?
It's, in my judgment, it's impossible to do this.
It will be impossible to restore it.
That's correct, which is why I can't imagine how you'd set a bond level on it.
Okay, thank you.
I guess you'd ask for an impossible amount of money.
Yes, perhaps so. Thank you very much.
Thank you for being here. I really appreciate it. Next up is Lance Trasky. Mr. Trasky, please come forward. Nice to see you here. Welcome to the committee. Put yourself on the record once you're settled in, and give us your testimony.
Chairman French and members of the committee, my name is Lance Trasky. I have 42 years of experience as a fisheries research biologist, a habitat biologist, and a regional supervisor with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, issuing habitat permits for projects like this. Establishing a restoration bond for the proposed Chewitna coal strip mine will be very difficult because there's nothing in the scientific literature or in the projects cited by PACRIM and the Alaska Department of Fishing of Natural Resources which supports the claims that recreation of a wild Pacific salmon stream and its associated drainage after strip mining has ever been successfully accomplished or is even feasible. It is also unlikely that the spawning channel and rearing ponds at PACRIM is offered as interim mitigation for the loss of salmon production from Chewitna River tributaries for 25 to 50 years would be successful in maintaining these stocks, which are likely genetically unique. The Chewitna River is known as the Kenai of the West Cook Inlet. Chewitna River supports substantial runs of all five species of Pacific salmon. It's an important contributor to the Cook Inlet commercial and subsistence fisheries. It is believed to be the major source of Chinook salmon to the Tyonic subsistence fishery, and the Chewitna is the major Chinook salmon producing system on the west side of Cook Inlet and supports a sport fishery second only to the Deschke River. The Board of Fish has recently declared the Chewitna River stock a concern because of shortfalls in escapement and the value of this fishery. In the first phase of mining, PACRIM has proposed to strip mine 8,000 acres of the three major Chewitna salmon-producing tributaries. Mining would remove 11 miles of one tributary and all the surface and subsurface features down to a depth of approximately 300 feet. That's what this stream drainage would look like afterwards. PACRIM would have to redo this, they'd have to recreate this entire upper stream drainage from bedrock on up, from that hole in the ground all the way up, fill it up with dirt, and build a stream on top of it. Recreation of both surface features such as wetlands, and subsurface features such as the shallow and deep aquifers, which provide critical groundwater to flow to these three major tributaries, would be necessary. Because sockeye, chinook, and coho salmon select areas of upwelling groundwater for spawning, and the input of warm groundwater is essential to the overwinter survival of salmon legs and eggs and larvae in cold climates, the creation of a shallow aquifers would be one of the most critical elements in creation of a new salmon stream. Finally, an 11-mile-long stable steam channel and riparian area, incorporating all the complex and interconnecting structures and processes that allow salmon to successfully spawn and rear, would have to be constructed on top of 300 feet of mine tailings. This has never been done and is likely not feasible. Both PACRIM and DNR have provided examples of projects which they claim support their contention that creation of a productive salmon stream after strip mining is feasible. I have reviewed these projects and have personal experience with most of the Alaskan projects cited. These projects do not support the contention that recreation of a new salmon spawning rearing stream is feasible. None of the examples provided by DNR or PACRIM involve complete removal of entire drainage with its associated salmon spawning streams, aquifers, wetlands, vegetation, and then the subsequent recreation of a new functioning salmon stream with all the essential elements on top of the fill. The objectives of most of these projects was actually to improve habitat in damaged fish streams with no expectations that salmon or other fish species would be restored to pre-development levels of productivity. Only three of the projects cited by DNR PACRIM even involved salmon streams, and none of these streams were strip mined. Projects involving grayling or catfish have no relevance to the Chiritna because they have very different life histories and habitat requirements. None of the projects that they cited did mention restoring groundwater either, and I don't believe that any of them did. All of the Alaskan projects cited by DNR and PACRIM as examples of the feasibility of restoring the Chiritna drainage after strip mining are small scale compared with the proposed Chiritna coal project, which includes 21,000 acres of leases and over 8,000 acres in the first phase of mining. In contrast, the Valdez Creek mine, which was cited by DNR as an example of how a strip mined stream could be restored, and this was the largest placer mine in Alaska. It was only 640 acres, and only a mile of a grayling stream, not a salmon stream, was restored. State and federal biologists have also questioned the feasibility of salmon restoration. In a 2007 letter to the Environmental Protection Agency, the National Marine Fisheries Service concluded that Chiritna coal strip mine would cause permanent impacts to the Chiritna watershed and associated salmon habitat. NIMS stated, "We are aware of no example of successful salmon stream restoration at this scale." In the Diamond Chiritna coal project final environmental impact statement, EPA also included, "It's questionable whether mine through streams could be restored to pre-mining productivity. Therefore, fish productivity could be a long-term loss." The Alaska Department of Fish and Game provided the following response to a letter from DNR asking whether reclamation of the Chiritna coal strip mine was feasible. Fish and Game responded, "While we are aware of small-scale successes in reclaiming certain stream functions, we are not aware of any evidence documenting whether large-scale reclamation of ecosystem function can or cannot be accomplished." In the process of reviewing all these Alaskan projects cited as examples of successful post-mining stream restoration by DNR and PACRIM, I asked a number of the fisheries biologists and hydrologists who were involved in developing these projects if they believe that these projects demonstrate that restoring thousands of acres of strip-mined salmon streams, aquifers, and drainage was feasible. They all said no. They were also unaware of any examples of where salmon-producing drainage, which had been removed by strip mining to depths of several hundred feet in a new stream created on top of the mine overburden, actually occurred. PACRIM has proposed to construct a spawning channel and rearing ponds to replace salmon production from Chiritna tributaries lost to mining during the 25 to 50 years before a new stream could be created. DNR has cited salmon usage of Forest Service gravel pits adjacent to Granite Creek on the Kenai Peninsula and two Canadian spawning channels as confirmation that these methods could replace lost salmon production. However, we do know that all the other Canadian spawning channels and all the spawning channels that have been constructed in Cook Inlet in the last 30 years, and there's been a number, have all failed over time. They have not worked.
Mr. Tresky, you want to speak to that a little bit more? I never heard of a spawning channel before. I take it it's an artificially created.
Yes.
It's not as if you're stocking a lake or stocking a stream. It's something different.
Well, in some cases, they'll find a suitable place where there's upwelling groundwater. They'll dig a channel in a location near an existing spawning stream. And usually in Canada, what they've done, they've built these spawning channels because all the spawning habitat in these streams has been cemented, mostly due to logging in these drainages. So they can't spawn in the stream anymore, but they think there's still good drilling habitat. So they build a spawning channel.
Nearby,
right. And they pump in clean water, usually not from the stream that's got a lot of sediment, and through pipes and everything, and it'll upwell in the bottom of the stream trying to create natural channels. Fish will come in from the adjacent stream where they can't spawn anymore and spawn. A couple of them have worked, a lot of them haven't. But they've built 30 of them in Cook Inlet. I'm sorry, they've built a number of them, Cook Inlet aquaculture over the years in Cook Inlet, and they've all failed over time.
That's interesting. And who's building them? Was it
Cook Inlet Aquaculture?
And they're I guess I don't know who they are.
Oh, they're the Aquaculture Association for Cook Inlet that it takes money from fish taxes and stuff and uses it to plant
to build
fish.
Habitat.
Oh yeah, the Trail Creek Hatchery.
Okay,
that sort of thing. They stock silver salmon. That's where fishermen catch.
Oh sure. Okay.
So they're pretty good at what they do,
but they haven't had success building.
Spawning channels.
Yeah,
in Cook Inlet.
Right.
So, similarly, they also cite Forest Service gravel pits at Granite Creek that were connected to the creek and were used by juvenile salmon for bring. And some of them have worked, but similarly, other gravel pits, such as the pit that Fish and Game and DOT tried to convert at Court Street, just down the road from, you know, I'm sure you know where Court Street is, tried to convert that into a salmon spawning and rearing system. And it failed miserably. In fact, it ended up killing a lot of salmon because of groundwater problems. We didn't get the kind of groundwater that we were supposed to on parts of the stream dried up. So,
but are you talking Quartz Creek near Cooper Landing?
Yeah.
There's salmon in there.
Oh, there's a lot of salmon in Quartz Creek. But where there isn't salmon is in that gravel pit that DOT built to expand that road. We tried to convert that into a salmon spawning and rearing pond, just like they're talking about doing here at Chewitna. That one failed.
Why did they fail?
That one failed because they fail for all kinds of reasons, and I'll tell you the biggest reason at all in just a minute. But they fail primarily because you're not getting enough groundwater in there. If you don't get groundwater in there all the time, you know, all seasons of the year, in the winter they freeze out and go anoxic, or in the summer the outlet stream dries up and the fish can't get in or out. So they fail for lots of reasons. They failed. Most importantly, the presence of invasive northern pike in the Chewitna drainage.
And so, Mr. Trusky, hold on one second. I'm sorry. There's one more question.
I'm sorry.
So, are you aware of any salmon streams that have been removed or destroyed that have been anywhere in the world that have been successfully rehabilitated?
Not on this scale. I mean, we've done small scale. In fact, my region, actually, if you're familiar with the Kenai River and stuff, we are the people that really brought fish habitat restoration into Alaska.
All the bank work
on Kenai River,
walkways, miles, shading, netting. Yep. It's extremely well done, but it's expensive.
It's small scale. We're just fixing a bank. We're not removing the whole Kenai River drainage down to 300 feet, dumping the remaining dirt back in and building the Kenai River on top of it.
I'm glad you brought this up. It's occurred to me what this hearing would look like and what this building would look like if this idea were being proposed on the Kenai River. You know, it would be mass
insurrection. You'd have to have the troopers here.
Right, right.
Can I get a sense, how big of a river are we talking about here?
Okay. Have you been over there?
It's about the size of Chena for Senator Pacquiao, and the Chewitna is. And bigger than Deep Creek, you know, and then the Nelchik, bigger than that. Mm-hmm. And the one tributary we're talking about is like Campbell Creek.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Pretty cool. Maybe Ship Creek, about that size.
Yeah, that helps put it in context.
Anyways, because of the presence of invasive north pike and that Chewitna drainage, any attempt to sustain salmon production by spawning channels and rearing ponds is unlikely to succeed. Salmon thrive in these low gradient environments and have extirpated salmon and trout from all the lakes, gravel pits, Cheney Lake in Anchorage, you're probably familiar with that, and slow-moving streams throughout south-central Alaska. It's unfortunate they're in there. They can't use the rest of the system. It's too high gradient. The existing system will work. They don't go in there, but the these marine ponds and stuff are perfect habitat, and you won't raise salmon in those ponds. So, anyways.
Is there northern pike in that region?
Oh, yes. Okay. Yeah. There's, unfortunately, Theodore Creek, they've wiped all the salmon out of Theodore Creek. That was a terrific producing stream. But unfortunately, the best salmon rearing streams, particularly for silvers, are these low, swampy type of streams with lots of wetlands because they're very productive, and silvers really grow in there. But that's what pike like. And unfortunately, we have them now. And we're trying to figure out how to get rid of them.
So why aren't the pike decimating this area now?
The problem is that most of that stream, except for the lower part of it, is pretty high gradient. And pike like...
Gradient meaning fast?
Wide slope, fast water, you know, rapids, pools, you know. They don't like that kind of stuff.
Like
they don't
lose the lakes.
Oh, yes, yeah. If you fish for pike, you know where they are.
And are you saying that you couldn't, this couldn't be restored in a way to keep it high gradient?
No, I'm saying you can't sustain the runs by building spawning channels and gravel pits, which are essentially little ponds and low gradient spawning channels, because the pike will just go in there and eat whatever you produce. Now, they won't eat, and they haven't eaten the salmon that are produced in these high gradient tributaries. So,
please proceed.
In conclusion, I have not found any independent restoration experts in Alaska or elsewhere, including all the people I work with, scientific studies or projects cited by DNR and PACRIM that support the contention that reconstruction of a salmon stream with its whole drainage, we're not talking just about a stream channel, we're talking about the whole drainage, the hills, everything. The reconstruction of a salmon stream on top, and its confined and unconfined aquifers, wetlands, and other essential elements on top of 300 feet of mine overburden is feasible. Restoration of a strip mine salmon producing drainage would be exponentially more difficult than small-scale projects to route a stream around a man-made barrier, revegetate stream banks like on the Kenai, or attempt to confine an unstable placer mine stream to a single channel. In considering standards for bonding mines such as Chewitna, legislature should keep in mind that all of the techniques cited by DNR and PACRIM as examples of the feasibility of recreating salmon stream drainages were developed in the Pacific Northwest and British Columbia in an attempt to halt or reverse the continuing decline of valuable and endemic fish salmon populations due to habitat loss. Billions of dollars have been spent in the U.S. and Canada with little or no success. If the project cited by PACRIM and DNR is proof of the feasibility of recreating a salmon stream work, these methods would be used everywhere, and salmon populations would be increasing, not declining everywhere. The problem is that from a salmon habitat perspective, the effect of permanent landscape changes, such as the deep strip mining proposed for the Chewitna River drainage, probably can't be reversed. Currently, DNR has considerable discretion in setting bonds amounts. It is important to recognize if the state allows strip mining through a wild salmon stream at Chewitna, it will set pace state policy that will endure. So in light of the fact that there's nothing to indicate that restoration of strip mine salmon drainages to pre-mining functions and values, or that artificial maintenance of genetically unique runs is feasible, the legislature should take a hard look at whether mining through salmon streams is a precedent the state should pursue. If so, there will need to be some very difficult discussions about how to put a value on the loss of a renewable resource, wild salmon, in perpetuity. So thank you.
Senator Cogtail has a question.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Trasky, thanks for all of the work you've done down through the years. So greatly appreciated.
Appreciate the opportunity to work for the state.
Help me understand the context of this. And I appreciate you putting it in the context of the size of the Chewitna River. That helps me mentally get a picture. So you're going up into this mining area. There's probably three or four tributaries, and then but you go further downstream, and when you start counting tributaries that go out, it looks like 10 or 15. So help me understand the context of the salmon spawning ranges in that area.
Well, there's tributaries to this. Some of them were low gradient and they have pike in them, and they weren't big salmon producers anyways. I think these three streams that they're going to be impacted by mining, and another one that may be impacted in later phases, produce almost all the salmon in that range.
Right. Yeah. Because I noticed there's some on the northern side and some on kind of the southwestern side that are main channels that are on the Tyonek River.
Yeah. You mean on the yeah, I know what you mean.
In that area, that they're not as productive? This is the main production?
I think that's it. We don't have the greatest information, you know, on that, on all that, because the state, frankly, hasn't the money to study all these things outside of what was mined. But from my experience over the years and in talking to the biologists and stuff, these seem to be the major producers of sockeye, coho, kings. I think it's a big king salmon producing stream, and silvers.
Yeah. And just for me, you know, if it's up to us to start sending mining limits, it would be nice for us to know what the context is.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
And so that may be something that I'll drill down into further.
Well, the other thing to consider is because these shallow aquifers are essential to producing salmon in Alaska. You cannot produce salmon here without having that flow of warm groundwater into those streams in the winter. You can have a grayling stream that freezes to the bottom in the winter, and they all do, but that doesn't hurt because the grayling all leave in the winter, and they all head out and into deep water. So, you know, not only is that groundwater coming in there, but the deeper aquifers that are going to be destroyed, and you can see there's a number of them, actually are maybe feeding parts of the Chewitna a considerable distance downstream. And in fact, this water may actually go as far as over as Beluga, you know, and people, because there's artesian wells over there, so... We don't know the full impact of how disrupting all that groundwater is going to affect this whole system, but we know that that it's critical because the salmon, eggs, and fry are there all winter. They have to be there, and they have to. They can't freeze out. They have to be there. That you've got to have that shallow groundwater in there, and nobody's ever produced it. And I've looked for about 10 years.
Mr. Chairman, just one other question. This is more curiosity, I think. Are these enhanced at all? In any of these?
No. All the enhanced streams that are, of course, Shipcree, and then some down, I think, to Nedelchik maybe. And, of course, the Cook Inlet Aquaculture does stock, you know, silvers for both commercial fishermen and sport fishermen, Seward, and other places. No, they're not.
It just seemed to me, Mr. Chairman, that if they were enhanced, they probably would have a little more study base to them. That's all.
It's possible.
Yeah.
Well, We're going to have to move on. Yeah, that's quite okay. A fascinating witness, a great body of information there. I appreciate your making yourselves available to us in person today.
Thank you. Very helpful.
We do have one more witness, Dr. David Chambers. Please come forward. Welcome to the committee. And put yourself on the record. Tell us who you are affiliated with, if anyone, and we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
Chairman French, members of the Judiciary Committee, my name is David Chambers. I'm a geophysicist by training. I work with an organization called the Center for Science and Public Participation. We're a nonprofit, and we provide technical analysis on the environmental impacts of mining, mainly to public interest groups and to tribal governments throughout North America, U.S., Canada, including Alaska. I'm the mining guy, the geologist, so I can maybe address some of the questions about what's going to happen during the mining. But one of the areas that I have worked with for a number of years is mine reclamation and mine reclamation bonding. Reclamation is not restoration. And the goal of reclamation is normally to restore some sort of functional use to the land that's been mined, because that process of mining is very disruptive. And in every example that I'm familiar with, the goal of the reclamation has been to restore surface use, a functional use. So not necessarily put it back like it was, but try to restore some sort of use. That could be wildlife habitat, grazing, industrial use even. I am not familiar with any reclamation project that has included restoring the groundwater regime to pre-mining. In the case of Chewitna, if you wanted to try to restore this hydrologic regime, there are a number of difficulties that you would encounter. As we've heard, there's going to be up to 300 feet of water-bearing strata that would have to be restored. Technologically, that would be very difficult. One of the reasons it would be difficult is that the geology out there of that 300 feet is fairly complicated. It's complicated by faults that run through the area. There's the Chewitna Fault and the South Pit Fault. And associated with this faulting, there are anticlinal structures. That's just a fancy way of saying that the original horizontal-lying sediments have been bent. And if I could refer to this.
Sure.
Is that all right?
Yep. Just speak up a little bit while you're over there so that we get your words on record.
So here's sort of a cartoon of what that area might look like now. So we have a number of different strata, including coal seams. Some of these strata would be water-bearing, that's what we're calling groundwater aquifers. Some of these strata would actually be non-groundwater bearing and would actually restrict the flow of water. Those are called aquitards. In addition, what we're not showing here is faulting that would offset those beds. Those faults can either be, depending on the nature of the fault itself, conduits for water, or they could be barriers for water, and you would need to know that. And then these anticlines basically would be big warps in these structures. So if your goal is to restore that groundwater hydrology, the first thing you have to know is what's it like before you disturb it. And I can say with a fair degree of reliability that the pre-mining sampling that has gone on so far is not sufficient to really define what this area is like hydrologically. Hydrologically meaning where is there water, where is there not water, how fast is it flowing, what direction is it flowing, how much of it is there, and what's the quality of that groundwater. So those are all very important elements. And quite frankly, that's not required of mining operations these days, because the goal is not to restore that hydrologic regime. The goal of mine reclamation is to put the surface back in a usable form, not the subsurface. So the first step would be required to know what's there, and then you've got to put it back. This is sort of a cartoon, again, that shows what happens when you mine. It's fairly destructive. And what we see in this bottom picture is that with all the mining reclamation examples that I'm familiar with, you basically sort things into two categories. You have the fill material, and then you have, we can't really call it soil in most cases, but it's growth material. And there's much more of this fill material than there is growth material. Growth material is generally 6 inches on top to promote the growth of grasses and trees and shrubs. But you do really jumble all the stuff back and put it back in the hole. So again, this looks completely different.
Let me just ask you about that sort of from a layman's perspective. You remove the overburden. I guess you put it somewhere. You take the coal out. How do you just sort of get the material balance back? You've removed the coal, and it's been shipped somewhere and burned. If you're going to bring back in enough stuff, that's the scientific word, stuff, to sort of fill the hole back in, where does that extra stuff come from?
Normally, the problem in mining is that you end up with too much stuff. Coal's a little bit different in that you are subtracting a fair amount of the original volume. But with mining, you have what's called an expansion factor when you mine the rock. And the best way to visualize this is visualize a cube of material. Now, if you take that and break it all up into, let's say, little cubes, you're never going to be able to fit them all back together.
I see.
They're not going to fit.
Right.
So you get an expansion factor, and that expansion factor is usually about 1.5. So the problem is generally you've got too much to put back rather than not enough.
Okay.
But the other thing about this material that you're mining is when you break it up like that, you're changing the physical characteristics. It no longer looks like it did in those layers, and it no longer behaves hydrologically and perhaps even geochemically like it did, because when you break this stuff up, you open up the possibility of physically mobilizing things that weren't mobile. And in mining, mining's case, things like arsenic and selenium are things that tend to be mobilized just as a result of the mining process. And then finally, if you're going to try to recreate that groundwater regime, you'd have to do selective sorting of the material, selective storage, again, which isn't really done except on this sort of soil versus general backfill case. And then even if you sorted it and stored it, you'd have to put it back like it was. And that would require a whole another level of work than what's done with mining now. I mean, we basically just push everything back in, pack it down a little bit, put some soil on top, and go away. But recreating a groundwater system would be a whole other level of engineering. So because of all these complications, I think, to me, first of all, I'm not aware of any mining operation where the reclamation goal has been to restore that groundwater regime. It's mainly focused on surface. If you tried to do that, it would be very expensive. It would be unprecedented in terms of trying to bond for it or estimate those costs, because it really hasn't been done, and the methods haven't been perfected. From my perspective, I think it's just highly unlikely that you could do that from a technological standpoint. Now, having said that, I think the question you should ask me is, well, why does it matter?
Why does it matter?
Why do we need to put it back like this? You know, why shouldn't we just
push it back
and restore the surface and make sure things grow nicely? And the answer to that is that salmon have different reproductive requirements than sort of the grayling and the other fish that. So to me, you know, to my mind, not being a salmon biologist, it's, well, yeah, if the water's back in the channel and it stays there and fish swim up it, it's good. But it's not good for salmon, because they need that groundwater source to overwinter and to spawn. So if you don't restore the groundwater regime, you lose the spawning habitat for salmon.
Just remind me, while we've got you for just about another minute, I'm afraid, because we've got to make sure we have a good time for the Department of Natural Resources to make their presentation, how much surface area is going to be disturbed under this proposal?
I don't remember exactly, 11 square miles.
I thought it was 11 miles of stream. I'm not sure if it's... Yep.
I don't know what the surface area of the leases are.
That's fine. Senator Wilikowski.
So could this be restored for like some exorbitant amount of money, or are you saying it's just impossible to restore it?
It's my opinion, and it's just that, again, because it's never been tried, but I don't think you could do it, because you're, first of all, you'd have to spend a lot of money sampling, and you'd have to get that right, and there are issues with ever doing that. It's kind of like weather forecasting. I mean, you can go out and put a weather station, you know, every square mile, but you still may not get enough data to predict what's going on. And we'd face that same fundamental issue with putting this back. And then you'd actually have to go out and do it. You've disturbed the material that you've mined so highly to begin with, and the requirements physically to get the right stuff back in the right place to restore that groundwater system would be extremely difficult.
My staffer has brought me Mr. Trasky's testimony. It's 8,000 acres is the surface disruption, which is probably close to, 11 miles of the stream, probably close to 10 square miles, if not a little bit more. Further questions?
Just one small question. You know, because of my reluctance to say nothing can ever work in Alaska, your advocacy role looks like to me in what your advocacy generally has been to show environmentally why mining can't work. That's what it appears to me. Just help me understand. Is that accurate, or am I overstating it?
No, I wouldn't. So let's talk about coal. I mean, I think the whole issue is this an appropriate place to do this kind of activity? So where would you mine coal in Alaska where you wouldn't have these kind of impacts. And I think the mining that's going on at Healy right now is probably a good example of where you can mine and not have these kind of impacts, because they're just, I mean, there may be a few salmon up there, but not like this.
And Mr. Chairman, I wanted to ask you, because for those viewing, it's important. We get a lot of public testimony here and advocacy, and obviously you work for advocacy groups, and so I just wanted to put that out. But your question is well taken.
Yeah, that's fair. Fair question, fair answer. Thanks so much for being here. I really appreciate it. I really do. A lot of excellent witnesses this morning, this afternoon. Next up is the Department of Natural Resources. We have Tom Crawford and Russ Kirkham, who are, I believe, in Anchorage, but are going to have some assistance from Ms. Cha. Welcome, Ms. Cha Temple. Nice to see you. Welcome to the committee. I don't know if you have to put yourself on the record, but maybe you probably... You're saying no. You're just going to push the button. Very good. Okay, so Tom Crawford and Russ Kirkham, whichever one of you is going to be the lead person, go ahead and introduce yourself. And Ms. Cha is queuing up your PowerPoint. I think it's in front of the committee, in front of the audience right now. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Tom Crawford. Can you hear me okay?
I can, and I think I'm getting head indicators from the back of the room that you're coming through loud and clear.
Okay, thank you very much. And just for the record, I am the director of the Office of Project Management and Permitting and DNR, and I'm joined here today by Russ Kirkham, who heads the coal regulatory program within the Division of Mining, Land, and Water. And we're here to give you the committee a background about the mine permitting and reclamation bonding process in the state. And so I will launch into this presentation. It's a lot of text. I'm going to try and go through this pretty quickly. But this is going to begin with a background about mine permitting in general, and then segue on to reclamation bonding and some coal-specific considerations.
Mr. Crawford, that sounds good. You've got about 25 minutes. Just keep an eye on the clock and pace yourself accordingly.
Okay, well, I'm going to try to move very quickly here. So I think the second slide here is a picture of mining projects across the state. I think in the interest of time, we'll just blast on by that and go to now slide four, which is just a list of permits. And this both state and federal. And the point here is that there are many, many different permits for mining projects, both hard rock and coal, and there are a great number of different state and federal agencies that are involved, as are shown on the next slide here, that list those state agencies, both state and federal. On the state side, the state employs a large mine permitting team approach to this that brings the representatives from all of the state agencies to the table. Under that statutory reference there, AS 2705-010B, the Department of Natural Resources is the lead state agency for coordinating this permitting process. But in addition, on the federal side, you see those federal agencies there that are involved, and that includes the regulatory and consulting agencies, and then if federal lands are involved, federal land managers. The state's large mine permitting team is involved with the review of many different applications and supporting documents for all of these various different permitting requirements. There's a lot of analysis and evaluation of those materials that need to be submitted by project applicants. We do have a variety of technical experts in that reside within the different state agencies: geologists, hydrologists, engineers, biologists, a broad range of expertise. A big point, though, is that if we don't have that expertise, then we go out to hire someone who does. And so we're not limited by the the makeup of the folks that are within our agencies, we can go out and acquire additional expertise when needed. And the same group of individuals that's involved in the permitting process is subsequently involved with the inspections and monitoring of mining projects if indeed they transition into operation.
Mr. Crawford, we've got a question here from Senator Wilikowski.
Would the Tuitna mine fall under federal jurisdiction? Would there be federal agencies involved?
Through the chair, yes, sir. There would be federal jurisdiction involved as well. For the Tuitna project, we're currently in the SEIS, or the Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement process, and that process is being led by the Army Corps of Engineers. There is participation by EPA, Fish and Wildlife Service, and National Marine Fisheries Service as well.
Thank you.
Moving on here, the mine permitting process is largely driven by the Federal National Environmental Policy Act process for an environmental impact statement. Say that process for Tuitna is currently being managed by the Army Corps of Engineers. It's important to understand that this is a tool, a mechanism for considering potential impacts from projects and evaluating on alternatives. An EIS, or in the case of Tuitna, a supplemental EIS, is not a permit itself. That process is triggered by the application for a major federal permit, and in this case, a wetlands drill and dredge and fill permit that would have to be issued by the Army Corps of Engineers. And then there's the purpose and need, the proposed project, alternatives to that project, all of these things that you can see there listed under the sub-bullets, under the second bullet, are portions that need to be included. And this, just for reference purposes, make sure we're on the same slide together. I'm speaking to slide number 7. And then this involves the designation of the lead federal agency, the Army Corps of Engineers in this case, and a third-party contractor is selected to manage that EIS process. There are multiple public notice and comment requirements embodied within NEPA and the process for an EIS. And the state participates as a cooperating agency so that we have a seat at the table throughout, and we work to coordinate our permitting process with NEPA to make this as efficient and as intelligible a process as possible to the public. Moving to slide number 8 here, there are a variety of baseline studies that are required. There's a list of them that you see there. And in order to help assure that that the right information is collected, the state and federal agencies consult with the applicants in advance to help, you know, advise them on what information to be collecting and the methodologies to be employed. Again, the idea is to make sure that when the information is submitted, it's the information, the right information to inform the permitting process.
And Mr. Crawford, let me just ask you quickly about the groundwater quality and quantity aspect there on the baseline studies. We've just heard from Dr. Chambers about how difficult it is to, first of all, just measure what's under the ground and to sort of know what's there before you begin, but more importantly, to recreate that underground structure. How far along in the process is this mine? Is that baseline study work begun, or is it still pending?
Much of that baseline work has been done, and the agencies are in the midst of evaluating the groundwater model, the hydrological model that PacRim, the project proponent, needs to submit to the agencies. There are drafts of that model that have been presented for review by the agencies. I think it's worth mentioning here that that actually the acquisition of that information has thus far been a very major part of the process, and that the agency's review of the information that has been submitted to date has been a very large component of the permitting effort thus far.
Thank you.
Looking actually to Russ Kirkham here, and maybe you could inform me about a little further about the status of the review of that hydrologic model.
Oh, this is Russ Kirkham speaking. The hydrologic model, the state and federal agencies have met numerous times with the company, and this has been over the past couple of years. And we came back from their initial collection of data. We actually came back and told the company to go back out to the field and actually collect additional groundwater data because agencies were not satisfied with which was collected so far. So the collection of data is an iterative process. We'll review the data. If it's not sufficient, we'll go back out and we'll find the company to collect more.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Kirkham, thank you. And Senator Concon's question, and then Senator Wilikowski.
Sure. Just for what you have to do on permitting, the question came out on really kind of the scope. First of all, what is there pre-permitting, and then what will happen once tailing backfill happens? It's been told us that the water table may be near impossible to restore. So is that within the scoping of the water table study?
I think the
if the speaker could identify yourself, I'm sorry, we have to keep records, so just remind us who you are when you begin speaking.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. This is Tom Crawford, and the studies that have been done to date have looked at the groundwater hydrology of both the bedrock, that is that portion of the geologic section where the coal occurs, as well as the overlying glacial and sediments and soil, so the overburden. And all of that feeds into that groundwater model. And I know that their proposal, at least as thus far, has been to basically selectively handle those materials, and I heard Dr. Chambers refer to the issues associated with that, but to selectively handle those materials with a goal towards reestablishing the hydrology that's primarily within the overburdened glacial materials atop the current bedrock as it exists today.
Senator Wilikowski has a question.
Yeah, thank you. And it's kind of hard with you not being here. There were some pictures that have been put up by Dr. Chambers, I believe, and it's sort of an interesting graph that shows different sedimentary layers and water, underground streams, and things like that. And are you requiring them to restore this land to what it is currently, or are you just going to say go ahead and rebuild some channels for streams?
This is Tom Crawford once again, and I can't inform you of what the ultimate permitting decisions might be by all the agencies, but the goal, as has been stated, is to reestablish a hydrologic regime that would restore productivity to the system, and I think that the picture that I see from the document that I downloaded, which I think is what Dr. Chambers was referring to, I don't think is entirely illustrative of what's been proposed, because they are talking about selective handling and restoration of a near-surface hydrologic regime that would feed into the streams.
I think it's a fair, I'll just jump in and say I think it's a fair representation. I don't think anyone's saying that the diagrams we've been given are exact replicas. They're just meant to be illustrative. So I think the department has a fair response.
Right. Thank you.
Go ahead, and we're on slide 8. Go ahead.
Again, Tom Crawford, and I'm moving on to slide 9 here, entitled Monitoring Plans and Environmental Audits. And so there would have to be, for the project to proceed into operation, air quality, water quality, fish and wildlife monitoring plans that would have to be approved in advance. For mining rocks. We typically require environmental audits on a five-year schedule, and the reissuance of permits is tied to these five-year environmental audits that look at not only the performance of the operators, but also at the performance of the agencies in relation to their enforcement duties and their overall monitoring and oversight responsibilities. Those audits are conducted by third-party experts, and the financial assurances are revisited and recalculated based upon those audits. Now, this I'm speaking in general terms here, and in the coal world, there are some departures from some of these specific provisions here about audits and the timing of that, but the level of oversight and the essential components are really all there under the coal regulatory program as well. And I'm now moving on to slide 10 summary, that there are many, many permits. There are a lot of agency professionals involved, and we go out and get third-party experts when we need them. There's really a look at a wide variety of potential impacts, environmental, socioeconomic, as well as health impacts from these projects now. And there is this continued air, water, and fish and wildlife monitoring required. Then final bullet there is about financial assurances, which feeds in to the next portion of this presentation. And I'm now on slide 12. It says underlying philosophy at the top. And the idea there is that at no point in time is the financial assurance to be less than what would be required to accomplish the approved reclamation plan. And that bond amount can be increased at any time that it's shown to be inadequate. And so the reclamation bonding authorities are in AS 2719. These are for mining projects in general. There are state reclamation standards that apply regardless of what the land type is. And that bond amount is based upon a reclamation plan that needs to be put in place prior to initiating mining.
Let me just ask hang on one second. Senator Cogdell has a question, and then I do.
Yeah, just the underlying philosophy. One of the things that was brought for us today, the difference between reclamation and restoration, and when we're talking about bonding amounts, that becomes a very huge question. So is that something that gets in your view through this permitting process, or is this underlying philosophy based on reclamation, not the restoration of, the salmon habitat?
Reclamation is Tom Crawford again, is definitely not the same thing as restoration. And the regulations contemplate that there will be impacts to the environment as a consequence of mining. And the agencies collectively need to decide what those the reclamation goals and the acceptable reclamation plan will be. And in the case of the Chewitna project, that calls for restoration of a basic functionality to the system, to the hydrologic system.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, I have a question, and then Senator Wilkowski has one. On the underlying philosophy, I began this hearing talking about the trustees case versus Gorsuch, the one from 1992, dealing with this same mine, and I was taken by the Supreme Court's analysis in response to the position that DNR took at the time. The position DNR took at the time said that basing the bond amount on the assumption that the applicant will violate the permit terms is unfair and unnecessary. That's what DNR's position was. And the court came back and said that they believe that the DNR's reasoning and its assumptions are fundamentally flawed. The court said, we conclude that our coal mining laws requires DNR to base the bond amount on the assumption that the applicant will violate permit terms. Have you... is that absorbed somewhere in the underlying philosophy, or is this you know sort of a consideration that comes into play at a different place?
Mr. Chairman, Tom Crawford again. When when it's stated that the assumption must be that that the applicant will violate the permit terms, I'm not well versed in the thinking here, but I think fundamentally the idea is that if the applicant is unable to perform the reclamation, they in effect would violate the terms of their permits, and the agencies would need to be able to step in and conduct that reclamation, and that the bond amount should be adequate to allow the agencies to do that.
It's a topic for probably a topic for later debate. So there's no point in going back and forth on the point. But I appreciate your response, Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just I'm just wondering if you have a general comment on the opinion of the experts. They what I heard was from all three, it was they thought it was impossible to restore this area, and we heard testimony that they were unaware of any salmon habitat like this that has such a large scale that has ever been restored. And I'm just curious if you agree or disagree with those statements.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I am not a technical expert on that to opine on that. And further, I think maybe this is worth commenting on at this time, is that frankly, we're in a somewhat awkward position because there has been lands and suitable petition filed that DNR commissioner responded to and has subsequently granted reconsideration of that petition. And many of the issues that you're talking about here are subjects that are to be addressed during that reconsideration of the petition. And as a consequence, I think it would be inappropriate for me to speak to those at this point in time because of that reconsideration that's under process.
And I'll just jump in and say I had reviewed the commissioner's lengthy decision. I had considered making it part of the packet, learned from you that that was under reconsideration, and so it became a moot point, really. It's no point in distributing that decision when there's one likely to follow, and so that's where we are with that. Further questions? Gentlemen, you've got about five more minutes. Go ahead.
Okay, just moving on here to now, it's slide 13, the reclamation standard, and you can see that the statutory reference here is that mining should be conducted in a manner that prevents unnecessary and undue degradation and ultimately returns things to a stable condition. There are then in regulation a number of reclamation performance standards. I just highlighted the one there that refers to stream channels that have been disturbed, and they need to be reestablished into a stable condition or location. You can see that there are many other ones there as well.
I'm reading them, and I think Senator Wilkowski may have a question about one.
Thank you. On that point, the point was made before that you're not really rehabilitating the stream. I mean, this is a whole, really an ecosystem. And I'm just curious what the law requires. Does it require just that you rechannel and put in a new stream, or does it require that you sort of rehabilitate the whole area back to what it was in, or close to its original condition?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, I'm going to look to Russ Kirkham here for perhaps a little more technical detail on that. But I do know that the standards, the statutes and regulations do contemplate that there will be impacts from the mining process. And with this, I'm looking to Russ Kirkham.
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. As Tom said, there is the expectation of the Mining Act that there will be impacts. And as part of the Mining Reclamation Plan, the company, through its landowners, posted a Performance Reclamation Plan based on the approved post-mining land use. That post-mining land use is based on what the landowner wishes. So lots of areas in Alaska is all wildlife. So all the reclamation is done to promote wildlife. So if the channel has to be reinstalled to support wildlife, extra steps will be made to make sure that it does function in a way that's similar to what it was pre-mining. And,
okay. Thank you.
Moving on to slide 14 here, the reclamation plan general elements. I'm just going to move through this or move on pretty quickly. You can see here that these are some of the fundamental requirements, the topics that need to be addressed in the reclamation plan. And then the bonding calls for, the bonding statute says that there should be an amount that's not to exceed an amount reasonably necessary to ensure the performance of the reclamation that's specified in that plan. And that's the DNR commissioner's responsibility to establish that bond amount. We can't accept cooperative agreements between state and federal agencies about who holds that bond in a collective bond amount.
Maybe we could, we do just have a few minutes left, gentlemen. Maybe we could skip ahead to slide 21, because I think it's got some good examples of bond amounts you've set over the years, and it gives us at least some idea of what the range is. I see the biggest bond is required for the Red Dog mine at $304 million. Smallest looks like for the Nixon Fork mine at $3.5 million. Maybe talk about the Red Dog mine. Is that cash on deposit, or is it 10% down with the rest in corporate sureties? How does that work?
Mr. Chairman, Tom Crawford, the bond mechanisms can be varied. They can be cash, letters of credit. They can even be bullion. In the case of Red Dog, that's a letter of credit, and that's that very high dollar figure that you see there for Red Dog is because the post-closure water treatment is contemplated here to last essentially in perpetuity, that there's so much metal in that system they will have to continue to operate a water treatment plant as far as we can see into the future. And the other projects, Nixon Fork at the bottom end there, is a very small underground gold mine near McGrath, and a much, much smaller project. But you can see the range of numbers there that are involved with some of these projects.
I think we've got time for one last question from Senator Wilkowski. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do DNR's options include restoration work in different locations? So, in effect, substituting work elsewhere for this permanent location?
Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, my reclamation and mitigation can employ mitigation efforts elsewhere. These are typically requirements that is determined by the Army Corps of Engineers because we're talking about wetlands impacts, and the Army Corps of Engineers does allow the use of mitigation banks and a variety of different mitigation mechanisms. There are multipliers that are associated with these because typically if you have to move to off-site mitigation elsewhere, then a multiplier is added to basically a kind of compensate for that lack of immediate on-site mitigation.
But just to follow up, so I'm clear on Senator on the answer to Senator Wilkowski's question, is that currently not an aspect of the Chewitna mine permit?
Mr. Chairman, at this point in time, it is not. The permitting process hasn't proceeded to the point where those types of decisions have begun to be addressed.
Mr. Crawford, Mr. Kirkham, thank you both for being available this afternoon. I really appreciate the presentation from the Department of Natural Resources. We've got you're quite welcome. We've got a couple minutes left. If there's one witness from the Chewitna side that wants to come and just say a few words about what we've just heard, that would be helpful to set in context. And thank you, Esther Temple-Chaw.
Yes, Senator French, Senators David Chambers again. I'd like to make a general comment on permitting and then a little specific comment on Tewitna. On permitting generally, you know, I often hear the argument that, well, we've got 60 permits, so this is the implication there being that this is a comprehensive process and we will look at all the details as a part of that process. I would argue that that if you look at the history of permits and regulations, it's basically a bottom-up process. That is, each of these permits is a response to a problem that's happened. And so we write a regulation and require a permit to make sure that that problem doesn't happen again. But because it's a bottom-up process instead of a top-down process, it's not a comprehensive process. So just because you've got 40 or 50 or 60 doesn't mean that you've covered the whole entity. And in addition to that, I would also argue that if you, again, step back and look at the regulatory process, there's no one, certainly no individual permittee, but there's no one entity anywhere that has either the responsibility or the authority to step back and say, does this thing make sense? Nobody has the authority to do that because each, you know, each regulatory agency has its permit, and there are very narrow limits and very well-defined limits on those permits. Okay, now for the Tewitna project, I think it's legitimate to say, well, why shouldn't we mine through these streams? In other words, it's a public policy decision to say maybe giving up 11 miles of salmon stream is worth it for the coal development. I mean, that's a legitimate public policy question. When you bring us technical people up here, we're looking more specifically at, well, could you restore it if that's what the, you know, the goal of the project was, or as part of the project. And so that's what we're saying. We're saying we don't see that that's possible, and we don't see any examples anywhere of where that's done. So we're not trying to address this bigger public policy question, but that's sort of how I see drawing the line.
Thank you for those concluding remarks. Very balanced presentations on both sides. Fascinating issue. I don't envy the commissioner. It's an extremely difficult decision that he has to make here.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
Balanced only in part because we didn't have those who were proposing an investment in this. It would have been nice to hear from that end of the world.
I'm sure they'll get their opportunity, but that's a good point. I appreciate you pointing that out. That's a fair observation. If there's nothing else to come from the committee, we're going to go ahead and adjourn.